Liar, liar, pants on fire. We taunted each other with it when we were kids. The sting must have worn off. Even though fact-checking websites will review political claims and rate them from true to pants on fire, the stigma of lying appears to have largely subsided in America. Susan Jacoby observes this and more in a book called The Age of American Unreason in a Culture of Lies. And we hasten to add that this is not a new book. It first came out in 2009 and has received extensive revisions to catch up to the beginnings of the Trump years in Washington. It goes beyond lying to anti-rationalism and anti-intellectualism. Susan Jacoby, a prolific writer with 12 books to her credit, several of them focused on American thought and secularism. Her shorter work shows up at the American Prospect and the Daily Beast and the op-ed page of the New York Times. Susan Jacoby, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, and happy Valentine's Day.
Happy Valentine's Day to you. Your thinking echoed Richard Hofstadter writing about anti-intellectualism in 1963. You remarked upon a surge of anti-intellectualism since the 1970s, prompted or caused by what, do you think?
Well, first of all, it hasn't been anything continuous. And one of the reasons I wrote this new edition, which is really actually, it's about 40% rewritten, is when the first edition of The Age of American Unreason was published in 2008, most of the research had been done during George W. Bush's second term. Barack Obama, at the time it was published, Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton were competing in the snows of New Hampshire for the 2008 Democratic presidential nomination. And a lot of what has happened since Trump's election is people trying to figure out how we got from one of the most thoughtful presidents in American history to Donald Trump. And I think that's the wrong question. It's really what's been going on all along, regardless of who has been president. In 2008, when I first looked at it, I didn't even mention Twitter. And there was a very good reason. Twitter was just founded in 2006. At the time I wrote that book, it had only 1 million subscribers. The last time I looked, it had more than 320 million. In other words, all of the things, if I had written in 2008 that we would, in 2016, elect a president whose preferred mode of communication was 140, now moved to 280 characters, reviewers would have savaged me. They would have said, that's not possible.
Wow.
So that what we really have, I see Trump as a symptom, his election. He's become a cause since he's been president, but as a symptom of a lot of changes in our society having to do with shortened attention span, with not checking for facts in news, that were operating all along independently of whether George W. Bush or Barack Obama was president and allowed the election of someone like Trump.
So Trump is not an aberration as you see it. He is just a continuation of a trend.
Well, no. He is somebody. He's not a continuation of a trend,
but a representation.
We've never had a president like Trump. We've never had a president who lies brazenly, who says, I love the poorly educated, who says, I love words. I have the best words. The very best word of all is stupid. Have we ever had a president who said during his campaign, the very best word of all is stupid? What does that mean? But what he is someone who is a person whose personality and failings and his appeal for some people met with a lot of other changes in society. And one of those changes is certainly the shortened attention span and the looking only at news you already agree with from people you already agree with, which was a trend which was just a part of the digital era, which the real digital era didn't really begin until around the turn of the millennium. So we've got kind of a short curve. In other words, to compare Trump with John F. Kennedy in an era of completely different technology is a mistake. But to talk about the trends of the last 12 years or so that have enabled and continue to enable Trumpism is something else entirely.
You do spend a fair amount of time in the book on the Kennedy era, and there were great hopes for education, and there were great hopes for the use of education for things like to put a person on the moon, which we succeeded in doing in the 1960s. So how did we get from this reverence to education to what you certainly perceived in particular about some really negative feelings about higher education?
Not so much reverence for education as, I mean, first of all, education was more respected in the 1960s, and science was educated, too. I mean, if there was one thing about the Kennedy White House in the 1960s, it was loaded with experts for which Donald Trump has absolute contempt. But you don't need to go back to 1960 for that. And by the way, I'm very happy for your Northern California and Oregon audience to have a chance to make a little correction. You said something about opinions of higher education mm-hmm. are a lot lower now. That's not true. Opinions of Republican voters of higher education are lower now. What you're referring to is a poll conducted by the Pew Research Institute last year, and it's been misquoted over and over again, saying that Americans have a lower opinion of higher education. It's only one specific group of Americans who have a lower opinion of education, Republicans. The majority of the American public still thinks, and said so in a Gallup poll a year before, that higher education is extraordinarily important. And furthermore, the pay gap between college-educated people and all other people has never been higher in America than it is today. And those are not statistics from partisan institutes. They are studies from the Census Bureau and the Economic Policy Institute, which is a nonpartisan group. And so that there's the reason why a lot of Republicans don't think much of higher education is they think of it as a bastion of liberalism. Ah. But it has nothing to do with what higher education people think actually does for you. Everybody in America knows that you do better if you have a college education.
All right. Susan Jacoby, The Age of American Unreason and a Culture of Lies, is our guest. Back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute five. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We are proud to have Susan Jacoby as our guest today. She is the author of The Age of American Unreason in a Culture of Lies, now out in a paperback edition 9 years after the original, with about 40% of the book revised to catch us up to the Trump years in Washington. You can join the conversation on the Exchange about anti-intellectualism, anti-rationalism, anti-truth. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. We've talked in fairly general terms. I want to talk about some specific acts. In chapter one in the book, you bring up, you point to the use of the word folks, particularly by presidents. What's the issue there?
Well, that's a battle I actually lost 10 years ago. What I pointed out was that a lot of people in part of a misguided effort to pretend that they're just one of the boys or just one of the girls. Presidents before Ronald Reagan, they never used the word folks. Not to say it's not a word people didn't, perfectly good Anglo-Saxon English word that people used all the time in ordinary conversations. But presidents and political candidates were expected and expected themselves to speak in elevated speech. Seriously, think about the Gettysburg Address ending with, "We highly resolve that these dead shall not have died in vain, that this nation shall have a new birth of freedom, and that this government of the folks, by the folks, and for the folks shall not perish from the earth."
Point taken.
Now, there's a reason why not only Abraham Lincoln, but later presidents who weren't as great orators as he is, folks is an ordinary colloquial word. What it does is it talks down to people. It's not the same thing at all as calling people my fellow Americans, as Franklin D. Roosevelt did, as ladies and gentlemen, as a lot of other presidents did. What it is is people pretending to be just ordinary and using that kind of language, I believe, which now every television anchor uses. I believe it is an insult to people when the president of the United States or candidate for the presidency is speaking. I think we should that it's a measure of patronization and also lying about who you really are, to talk down to people that way. What's wrong with calling them fellow citizens, ladies and gentlemen? Ladies and gentlemen and fellow citizens, they imply a higher level of respect for people. But everybody uses the word folks now, and I totally lost that battle. I pointed that out in 2008, and now what was true of some people then is true of all politicians now.
You mentioned FDR, and he does show up in the book, no surprise, and he's a great case in point. I mean, how did we get from people aspiring to live up to rhetoric like the sorts of things he talked about to people like him sounding like they're talking down to people? I mean, is that the do you think FDR would be perceived that way now?
I don't think people would perceive FDR as talking down to people. And I don't think that also that people would perceive a candidate today who spoke in elevated language as talking down to people. The things we remember in American history, and this is so important, why does everybody who was alive then remember Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech? A speech in which, by the way, you won't find the word folks once. Because he spoke in highly elevated language to people. And it wasn't only highly educated people who responded to this speech. It was everyone. I think it's the most disgusting idea in the world to think that the way you appeal to, quote, working class voters is by speaking in a low and vulgar manner. And I'll give you another example. It's not just politicians. It's everywhere. In the Women's March, the first one, right after the day after President Trump's inauguration, Madonna spoke at a women's rally, and so that you needn't think I'm going to be using the whole word, but she made a speech and she said, F you, F all of you who say that this march isn't going anywhere. It's the beginning of much-needed change. Well, here's what's wrong with the F you. I agree with her. It was the beginning of much-needed change. We all know that the only answer to F you in personal life or public life is F you too. Speaking like that closes the conversation, just as Donald Trump's famous S-hole comment. These things don't open a conversation. They close it. They are insulting to people of every educational level. And this is part, it's not just Donald Trump, although he speaks more vulgarly than any American president ever has in public. It's part of what has happened in society. And it's why I say that Trumpism is a result, as well as now a cause, of things that have been going on in the larger society for a long time.
We are talking to Susan Jacoby about her book, The Age of American Unreason in a Culture of Lies, out in a paperback edition, about 40% updated from the original 2009 version of the book. You can join us on The Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email jx@jeffnet.org. So based on what you were just saying, I mean, the coarsening of the culture is involving many of us, and so electing a president who talks like us is not terribly surprising, I suppose. Is it? So
yeah,
you
talk like that in your home. I bet you don't. I don't either. And there are an awful lot of non-college educated people who don't talk like that in their homes either. I'm not sure we've so much elected a president who talks like us as a president who has somehow done this, a person who's done this so much, along with many other people at the public levels of society. And I do believe that it all stems from this mistaken idea that working class people, you know, don't want to be talked to like snobs. You know, I do a lot of lecturing at colleges in places like Gary, Indiana, North Conway, Arkansas, where a lot of the students I speak to are the first generation in their family to go to college. Often they're the children of immigrants. Their parents never had anything, and believe you me, a lot of these working class students are working three jobs to go to college and pay their tuition, and they're living at home because they couldn't afford to live in a college dorm and pay their tuition. And nobody, you know, putting down college, putting down learning, putting down science, putting down knowledge, all of these people like the Trumpers are wrong when they think that this appeals to working class people who are working so hard to get what, for example, people like Donald Trump took for granted as a birthright. He was going to go to college. His father was rich.
So how, if the rage is about not the learning that goes on college campuses, but the political attitudes of college campuses, and they don't help themselves, it would appear in a lot of cases, by trying to keep people of more right-wing positions off campus, what are some of the solutions you can potentially see here, Susan?
Well, first of all, lots of campuses have conservative professors. I do believe that the majority of the faculty at most of the best colleges in America are liberals, and I have no problem with saying this, that in general, the more educated people are, the less politically conservative they tend to be, although that's not always true. There are I know lots of great conservative professors at Yale and Harvard Law School, and they are very outspoken on the faculty. But one of the things that happens is that the loudest voices get heard. You know, I hate the term politically correct, for example, mm-hmm. because what politically correct really means is anything that I don't agree with. But I don't know what you mean when you say the colleges don't help themselves. Some years ago, I lectured at Oregon State University in Corvallis. Is that how it's pronounced?
Corvallis, yeah.
Corvallis. And I talked to a teacher who taught who isn't there anymore, who taught like Science 101, the uh-huh. introductory science course that everybody who goes to college had to teach. Now, she had a lot of students because that university has a lot of students from the Bible Belt part of Oregon, students whose teachers in high school never used the word evolution because the local school boards were afraid they would get flack from fundamentalist religious parents if they did. And a lot of these students would come to her, and they were very offended that she talked about evolution, and said that it was that their religion objected to any discussion of evolution, and they shouldn't have to study it. And what she told them is that they did have to study it. She said their personal views about it could be whatever they want, but she said they had to learn what the general scientific community accepts as part of the explanation for the origins of the universe and the origins of the human species, and they could believe what they want. Now, this seems to me a perfectly reasonable thing, and for everyone you hear who's politically correct and doesn't want conservative speakers on campus, there are teachers like this all over the country in universities who don't get a lot of publicity, who have all of the faults of our elementary and secondary school education to deal with, and who have to be very careful in how they talk and deal with students. I thought this teacher's answer was great. You don't have to believe it. You can believe whatever your religion teaches you, but you do have to learn to graduate from this university what science has to say about evolution. And that is just as common as anything you hear about political correctness.
Susan Jacoby, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is The Age of American Unreason in a Culture of Lies. You know, I wonder in particular about the bad feelings about elites. And, you know, elites can be described in a number of ways, you know, intellectual elites, economic elites. There's a whole bunch of different kinds of elites. And I wonder, when you have a lot of the country thinking along the lines, and test me on this, whether it's right or not, thinking that the majority of the political class, the elites, think they're better than us. I mean, how do you work around the reaction to that being that then we're not going to be like them?
It's not just the political elites. I would say that there are three professions, you know, that really are thought of in that way. One is the political class. One are professors. Even the word professor makes some people mad, and it used to be a term of respect. And one are, in particular, the media. Now, They think they're better than us. Well, I will say, I have to be careful about what I say here because I have an article coming out and I don't want to pillage from it. And I'll let you know about it when it comes out. But one thing that the elites, quote unquote, and again, it's a term like political correctness. It's a pejorative term. Did anyone ever call anybody a member of the elites 40 years ago? I mean, and it has nothing to do with money either, because there are obviously many members of the elites. I mean, I assure you, I have made less money as a journalist and the author of 12 books, and I started out as a reporter for the Washington Post in the 1960s. I make less money adjusted for inflation than my grandparents did. My grandfather owned a bar in Harvey, Illinois. But I do belong to a different class of people in the sense that I have a college education, which my grandparents were incredibly proud of. They were incredibly proud every time they saw my name in the newspaper. Now, the question is you would think right now that everybody, and there are loads of people like my grandparents still in this country today, who never in a million years wanted their children or grandchildren to go through the hardships they had because they had no education, who don't think about the elites or call them the elites. They think about people who are living out the American dream, which was that you do better than they did. And I think how people who are called the elites, one of the reasons you don't need to say, I don't think I'm better than you do. Who believes that? That's like saying, you know, when did you stop beating your wife? A question which is fairly apropos with today's news. But there is so much that you can do. You don't have to say you're better than anybody else to talk to them as if they are intelligent people. You don't have to talk down to them. You can talk about the value of a college education. You can talk. Do I sound in talking about these first generation immigrant kids who are working so hard to go to school that I think that I'm better than they, that I am better than they are? No. What you do is instead of sneering at anything, you make a point when you're talking to people about how they are getting a raw deal because it costs too much tuition for them to send their children to college. And if you have had the advantages that I have had, which was simply having advantages that my grandparents and one of my parents didn't have, then it's your obligation to help people to see that something changes. And one of the things, for example, professors could do is they could join hard in lobbying for lowering of college tuition, and they could and they should. Also there's something else that's really important. The whole concept of elites, in a way, in this country is still ridiculous because so many people who are considered parts of the elites are only one or at most two generations of people who worked hard with their hands so that we would not have to. Mm-hmm. I don't think you think if I were talking to an audience about people who worked so hard so we wouldn't have to, that they would think I think I'm better than they are? Well, I don't think they would, and I don't think they do, and I've talked to audiences like that. And I think you talk not by pretending to be, you know, folksy and say, oh, you folks, and all of that, you know, by showing them what an education can do for you.
Susan, we got about 2 minutes left, and I want to finish with this question. As you point out in the book, we have had anti-intellectual spasms in the past. Is this period graver in your mind than those?
Yes. Simply because there's one thing we've had fierce anti-intellectualism in the past, but I think that it is a graver situation now, simply because of the digital world that we all inhabit. We have had, I mean, for example, social media, the power of social media. We have had all kinds of lying journalism throughout our history, you know, beginning with the American Revolution, for that matter. We have never had social media that have had the power to spread lies so quickly over such a large geographical area. And I think that is the difference between anti-intellectualism today and the previous ones. Things that are absolute lies have the capacity to spread farther. And what's more, they make people forget what they know, what you don't need a college degree to know, but what you know from your own experience. Remember the pizza parlor story about how Hillary Clinton was supposed to be running a sex ring out of a pizza parlor in Washington, which is right near where my brother used to live. We've all been to our local pizza parlors. Can you imagine a worse place to sex traffic out of than your local pizza parlors, which generally are full of families? I assure you that if children were disappearing from the pizza parlor where I go, that's a block from me in New York, and I would see them being loaded into trucks, I would notice, and so would everybody else on my block. And this is New York. Imagine in smaller cities.
Sure.
But the internet has the power to make people forget. What if they think about their own experience? They would know makes no sense.
All right. The book is called The Age of American Unreason and a Culture of Lies, newly updated from its original version 9 years ago, now out in paperback. Susan Jacoby, thank you so much.
Thank you, Northern California and Oregon.